And now, part two of On the Town with Mark Stein.
Welcome back to our celebration of the music of John Barry. In part two of our show, more from John Barry's 007 quarter century, plus a few detours. Coming up, Don Black recalls his theme song for Diamonds Are Forever, and Tim Rice explains why his Octopussy song isn't called Octopussy. And David Arnold tips his hat towards some of John Barry's more lyrical, romantic scores of recent years. And we'll hear Don and John's great Oscar winner, Born Free. But before we return to our guests, I thought I'd take a crack at one of the Bond songs myself. Why not? Everybody else does. As David was saying, John's songs weren't part of the rock music world, but they have a strange cachet among the rock crowd. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Play. Harder than it sounds, isn't it, guys? Iggy Pop with David Arnold, as it happens.
We have all the time in the world. Time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store.
It's not all rockers wanting to appropriate a bit of Bond's cool. Here's the West End star, Maria Friedman.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me.
And if you don't care for musical theatre types, here's Kanye West.
Throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe. The rock is still alive every time I rhyme. Forever, ever, forever, ever, 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 ever.
You can see why rockers and rappers want to get a piece of the 007 action. There's a certain cachet that John Barry's Bond songs have. And listening back to all this great music while preparing for the show, I kind of got a yen to take a whack at one myself, so here goes. John Barry was both a composer and an arranger. And so in this number, we've tried to nod toward both sides. It's a John Barry tune, but in the arrangement, we've also used a lot of his distinctive Bond-style fills and figures. We're taking it just a wee bit faster than the original. And if they ever do 007 the musical, this number will be cued by Bond strapped to the laser table saying, "Do you expect me to talk?" And Goldfinger saying, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to sing." Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch, such a cold finger. Beckons you to enter his web of sin.
Don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you fear. A golden girl knows when he's kissed her. It's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. Her, it's the kiss of death, Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. He loves only gold, only gold. He loves gold. Don't go in his web of sin. He loves gold. This heart is cold.
A Bond song from Me to You with Kevin Amos and the band. Music by John Barry, lyrics by Leslie Bricus and Anthony Newley. And yes, I bottle out of the Shirley Bassey Big Finish. Wanted to do something a little more in keeping with that spooky Anthony Newley demo. Everyone loves Goldfinger. Here's the cast of the sitcom Frasier in the local piano bar.
Hey, I got an idea.
What?
Hey, buddy, let's go over here. Let's do a little singing. Come
Dad,
on.
Dad.
No, come on.
No.
Hey, buddy, can you play Accentuate the Positive?
No, I'm just noodling around. The real pianist doesn't come till 9.
Oh, well, you can fake it, can't you?
Well, no, not really. I actually only know 3 songs. America the Beautiful, Happy Birthday, and Goldfinger.
That's all right, buddy.
Thanks. No. Come on, guys. We're going to sing a happy song. Let's sing a happy song. Come on. Play Goldfinger.
We don't know the words to that.
Oh, come on. You knew it when you were kids. It'll cheer you up. Come on. Hit it.
Ridiculous.
Oh, come on, sing it.
Such a cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin.
That's it.
But don't go in.
John Mahoney, Kelsey Grammer, and David Hyde Pierce as a three-handed Goldfinger on TV's Frasier.
I mentioned right at the beginning we would touch on the shampoo commercial.
No,
because that's a good example. That may be the greatest music
ever written to accompany the rinsing and lathering of anybody's scalp.
Well, with maybe I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair, maybe. But
Don, yeah, I think you wrote with John more than anybody. You did Billy and then Brighton Rocker just a couple of years ago. Yeah. And he did a couple of other show score. He did Lolita with Alan J. Lerner.
Right.
But writing for the screen was his milieu. And then suddenly there's this little shampoo commercial that is just like the greatest shampoo commercial ever written. And where did that
come? Well, he just got a tune. I did a lyric to it, The Girl with the Sun in Her Hair.
I see her now as she walks by the sea, tanned by the wind and the salt air. Lovely but lost, as she waits silently, the girl with the sun in her hair.
It should have been recorded many times, actually. It was one of his favourites. It's just gorgeous. Silvercrin is the product. And typical John Barry. Are you familiar with that, David?
I know that, yeah.
You know, yeah. It's a terrific melody.
Yeah. Better. I mean, I know nothing against Silvercrin. I don't know that I've ever used it myself. But but it's like way better than the assignment called for. Yeah. Really.
I just don't think it's obviously not about shampoo, you know. It's like it needs to be about shampoo, so that gets put over there.
Yeah, just
and I'm going to write about something. I'm just going to write something, which will be for shampoo, but not about it.
He didn't write Silvercrin puts the ooh in shampoo. No. That was not a Silvercrin ad that stayed with me. Do you remember that one?
No, I'm happy to say that. But if you're doing a next series for Radio 2 on great shampoo commercials, then clearly you've got half the show there already.
Absolutely.
And before we get deluged in emails, yes, it's Sunsilk shampoo. Sunsilk, the girl with the sun in her hair. Every male TV viewer of a certain age around Britain and a lot of the British Commonwealth remembers watching various leggy lovelies strolling along with the sun in their hair to those Sunsilk commercials. Let's get back to the Bond movies proper. Don Black will take us behind the scenes on the 1971 007 movie Diamonds Are Forever. This is the theme tune for which, as you'll recall from part one of our show, John Barry advised Shirley Bassey to think of it as a song about a penis.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and caress it, touch it, stroke it and undress it. I can see every part, nothing hides in the heart to hurt me.
Harry Saltzman didn't like it. He said that it's ridiculous. He said the lyric you've come up with is filthy. It's to right. touch it, stroke it and undress it. And John Barry said to him, well, what do you know about songwriting, you know? And I've toned that down for this podcast. And Harry went out and slammed the door. Fortunately, Cubby Broccoli loved it and Shirley Bassey loved it.
I don't need love.
Tell me about this song, because I think this was this happened to you in New York. You met Steven Spielberg.
Oh yeah,
many years after Diamonds Are Forever.
Yes,
and
I was at Andrew Lloyd Webber's home in the Trump Tower when we were doing Aspects of Love, and he was having Steven Spielberg over for a drink. So he said, "Oh, Steven, Don Black, this is Steven," and I was just about to sort of, you know, faint and whatever you do. And he said, "You're not the Don Black, are you?" He said, which it really threw me. And I said, "That's a great line." He said, "Mate, you wrote the greatest title song ever, Diamonds Are Forever." I said, "Oh, thank you very much." I mean, but he didn't stop there. He went on. He said, "You know, the way the word luster hits the translucence of the," and he went on poetically about the lyric hitting, which was all Maurice Binder, you know, not me. But yeah, so there's people out there, they do notice these things.
Diamonds are forever, sparkling round my little finger. Unlike men, diamonds linger. Men are mere mortals who are not worth going to your grave for. I don't need love.
It's the kind of a template, I think, for a Bond opening sequence, that Diamonds Are Forever. The next Bond song you did with John was by the way, before we should say you made a version of that one, of Diamonds Are Forever too, David, with a
David McElmont.
Yeah, male, and I think that's the first male vocalist recall Diamonds Are Forever since The Bachelor. Was it The Bachelor's dinner?
God, I hope not.
I think, unless it's like some kinky fantasy of mine, I would swear I've heard The Bachelor's sing at all, and incredibly clunkily.
Diamonds are forever. They are all you need to please her. They can stimulate and tease her. They won't leave in the night, have no fear that they might desert her. Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then caress it. Touch it, stroke it and undress it. You can see every part, nothing hides in the heart to hurt her. She doesn't need love, for what good will love do her? Diamonds never lie to her, for when love's gone, they luster on.
She doesn't need love, for what good will love do her? Diamonds never lie to her.
Oh, right.
But so I think yours is the second.
David was we sang it very first person though. He was he was Shirley Bassey.
David who?
For three, David McElmont.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Right.
And we made an extraordinarily sort of camp video to go with it. But it was a brilliant vocal. Right. It was absolutely brilliant. And it was a kind of Bond fantasy idea. I mean, you know, what happens in the video is that I'm a sort of busking tramp in Soho, and David sort of steps over me and walks into this room where he's led into a, he sees a light behind a door, and he comes out and he basically is Shirley Bassey.
Diamonds are forever, they are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me.
He's got this kind of feathered one-piece cat suit and you know, heels and everything, and there's white cats and an orchestra, and I'm playing this big grand piano.
Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then press it. Touch it, stroke it, and undress it. I can see every part, nothing hides in the heart to hurt me.
You know, and then he emerges, once the song's finished, he comes back into the room and he changes back just to David McCalmont, and he leaves again. But no, it was extraordinarily arch. But I mean, I think that's why those songs work as well. You know, I mean, they do kind of wink at you. I mean, Don was always saying about, you know, right in the early days when we were doing Tomorrow Never Dies, you know, Don's theory of, you know, that the Bond song should sort of tempt you into the song. You know, it should beckon you into what's happening, and it should be seductive, and it should be suggestive, and it should be elaborate and not to do with the dull and the ordinary.
The boudoir,
that's it. Yeah.
I think that's a good. I mean, they teeter on the brink of self-parody, but without sort of tipping in. I mean, touch it, stroke it, and undress it is like you're going 99.8% of the way to the cliff edge, but without like hurling yourself over into it.
But what's interesting is that everyone else goes over the top. You know, whenever they do sort of Bond parodies or something, or when people try and write a Bond song, they always step over the mark, I think. But I think that the Bond songs as they are never knowingly arch. You know, I mean, they might become it somehow, but I don't think anyone intends to write something which is too knowing about what's going on. So it's like we've always said, I think, with the Bonds, it's like you have to be one step ahead of everything all the time. So there's so many songs which, you know, would have the big brass and the big strings, and they would have those overtly suggestive lyrics, but you know, they're always on the wrong side of the fence.
Because I guess The Man with the Golden Gun could have gone that way as well, Don, couldn't
it? It probably did with the opening line, you know.
He has a powerful weapon.
Yes. it's not exactly my Huckleberry friend. One was a bit on the nose. Funny enough, John was never a big fan of his tune on that.
Right.
It fit. He said it fits, but he was never. He said many times that it wasn't his favourite one. But Lulu did a good job of it. I think it did the job, kind of thing. But I don't regard it as a landmark moment.
And Lulu was kind of because it was like Lulu's second time around. I think she'd just had the David Bowie hit, whatever that was.
Man Who Sold the World.
Yeah.
Who will he buy?
when you're looking for someone to sing a Bond song, you want someone who's who's kind of got a certain cachet, but isn't just going to be around for 20 minutes.
I always felt like it should be someone who could be in the movie, you know. Right. And I think that was, you know, Shirley could obviously definitely have been in a Bond movie. Right. Tom could have been in a Bond movie.
I think
movie,
it helps if you
Nancy Sinatra.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm. I think it helps if you've had a life.
Mm.
Because then you sing Diamonds Are Forever or whatever. You read more into it if it's someone who's lived a bit.
Shirley Bassey returned for a third Bond theme. It was supposed to be Johnny Mathis, but he heard the song and he didn't like it. More fool him. It's another unlikely title, but a very haunting John Barry melody.
Why do you hide? Where is that moonlight train that leads to your side? Just like the moonraker goes in search of his dream of gold, I search for love, for some have a hold. I've seen your smile in a thousand dreams, felt your touch, and it always seems you love me.
Moonraker came out in the late 70s, and you know what that means. 00 Disco Sound.
Is that, that with great respect to others who've had a go at it, that Shirley didn't do the one James Bond song I did, because she can make anything sound fantastic. Actually, I think she did do it on an album which never came out.
She recorded an album of every Bond song that had been written.
It never was never issued, was it?
I think she bought that.
That would
have
been a big hit. I don't know why she didn't.
No, but she did one. Shirley Bassey sings Andrew Lloyd Webber. Well, you're all over that.
I saw you two. You just come from the studio where Shirley had been singing that, and and you were saying, "Oh yeah, Shirley's doing an album, all the Bond songs." And Tim said rather defensively, "Oh, is mine on there?" And you said, "Yeah, don't worry about it." But then,
well, when's it coming out, Don?
Yeah.
So it's been in the vault for 25 years or something.
That would be interesting to hear her version.
Maybe it has come out on a box set or something.
No, she. I think she bought the tapes. And
I think I heard it. I mean, I'm sure I remember going to a playback.
Right.
But it's not as great a song as Diamonds Are Forever, for example.
Actually, it's worse than David said. She bought the tapes back, and then the album wound up getting accidentally released anyway, and Shirley had to go to court to get the CD recalled and all copies of it recalled. And so this is the only vocal to to ever emerge from those sessions some years later when it was remixed for Shirley Bassey's hit album, Get the Party Started. Seemed to work. I don't know whether this is how it was, Don, is that once John had come in and established himself as the house composer, they then got different star lyric writers to come in and work with him. So Brickus and Newley, yeah. And then you came in and did Thunderball, and then Hal David did a song in on Her Majesty's Secret Service. I mean, was that the way they looked on it, or was it actually a far more accidental process?
I think it was a bit kind of random. I think it was. I mean, there was no loyalty that you do, if you've done one, you'll do the next one.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's none of that. I just think John was in London and he said, we've got the man with a golden gun coming up. Do you fancy that? You know, because we're having lunch or something, you know. Yeah. it wasn't thought through. And I'm sure with Tim, I don't know, he'd probably...
Well, I was amazed to get the call. I mean, and when he said to me, it's called Octopussy.
Right.
I thought, you thought Thunderball was bad. But funnily enough, in recent years, I thought actually if the song had been called Octopussy, it might have been a great song.
It would have been a good idea, I think.
At the time, I mean, I sort of laughed when he said, because first he said, you want to do, you know, are you interested in doing lyric for a James Bond film, which is a pretty stupid question, really. And I said, of course. And then I said, what's it called? And he said, Octopussy. I went, and we had a laugh about that. And then almost immediately we said, or John said, well, of course, that won't be the title of the song. And I said, fine, but I wish I'd had the nous to say, actually, it would be a good title, because it would have been great. You could have done something that was not crude, but interesting. But he just said, which is a very good move, he said, choose six titles. Just give them six titles and let them choose one of the six. Then it's their choice. And my great regret is I've lost...
The other five.
I have no idea what they were called. One about Argentina, I think.
Really? I love a Kansas morning.
Yes, that was it.
I think that's the opposite problem, really, of Don. Don was stuck with Thunderball, and it didn't mean anything.
Yes.
But he figured out a way to make it work. And I do think that. That's really the lesson of, I think, that Goldfinger taught, is that you don't turn it into the love theme from Goldfinger. You just go with...
I had the same with True Grit at the time. You know, it was a terrible title, True Grit. But I remember John Wayne.
Glenn Campbell did it.
Yeah, Wayne, a little bit of name dropping. David, I know you like that. He said to me, just get the title in.
So John Wayne, he didn't care as long as the words true and grit were in.
That's right, because it's advertising for the movie at that time.
Now, when you got the call, Tim, were you familiar with your predecessors, whatever it was, the 15 previous Bond films?
Oh, yes, I was pretty aware. I think I'd seen all the films, and I certainly was aware of all the songs, as far as I can remember. And I kind of assumed that it would be Shirley Bassey.
Right.
But we had Rita Coolidge,
right,
who was quite hot at the time.
All I wanted was a sweet distraction for an hour or two. Had no intention to do the things we've done. Funny how it always goes with love when
was a talk of that rather good girl, Laura Branigan.
Oh,
who's sad to say died.
Yes, yes, yes.
She was a great singer, and she was pretty hot at the time. And I,
Gloria, that was her big.
Yes.
Hit. Yeah, wonderful singer, actually. Yeah.
And I can't remember whether she turned it down or whether they changed their minds.
Right.
But, yeah. Of course, Jarvis Cocker did it under David's baton, which I was amazed. I was, I mean, you know, gave me street cred for 3 or 4 hours.
Now, wait a minute. Let's just get this. Let's get you on the record here, because Jarvis Cocker sort of talk sings the first
does,
the
yeah.
first 24 bars or something. Do you you like that?
Well, it was if it had been the first version of the song, I think I might have, you know, thought this perhaps isn't the way to launch this great melody, which I of course didn't write. Mm. But he's a very endearing character.
All I wanted was a sweet distraction for an hour or two. I never intended to do the things we've done. Funny how it always goes in love. When you don't look, you find. But then we're two of a kind. We move as one.
I was actually sitting in a restaurant in Barnes near Olympic Studios. I live in Barnes, and enter Jarvis Cocker, who came up to me, and I thought he wouldn't know me from a bar of soap, but he said, "I've just been recording one of your songs." I thought, blimey. You know, I mean, this was the most unlikely statement I expected from Jarvis Cocker coming up to my table. And I said, "Which one?" And he said, "All Time High." I think I said, "Blimey again." I was unaware of David's project. But I was very flattered that he did.
That's quite. I like those kind of stories. I like. I think it was an ASCAP meeting or something. Bob Dylan was a little late. Slides into the seat next to Sammy Kahn and says, "I've just recorded one of your songs," which is like Tim Rice and.
What was that song?
I think it was All My Tomorrows. Of all things.
My
Tomorrows. Wow! I just looked that one up.
But All Time High is strange, because that's almost as if that's getting into We Have All the Time in the World territory, isn't it? It's a real love song in a way.
Yes, I did write it as a love song, and I'm very ambivalent about it. Sometimes I think it's quite a good song, other times I think it's not. I mean, with great respect to Rita Coolidge, who I think is a fine singer, but wasn't. I don't think it was quite the right voice for a Bond film. Mm. She was a little bit too laid back and almost country.
I don't want to waste a waking moment. I don't want to sleep. I'm in so strong and so deep, and so are you. In my time I've said these words before, but now we're an all-time.
But I've heard it sung live on stage, you know, by several people, and when it's given a bit of a welly, it comes over quite well.
So if Shirley Bassey ever does release her version, yes, she'll blow the roof off the joint.
Well, a bit late now, I think. not from Shirley's point of view, but from the song's point of view. Hardly a new, brand new gem for the world. But no, listen, I'm just very honoured to be part of, the Bond legacy, if that's not a too corny a word.
The funny thing about this, Don, because you, I think you've written maybe more, film themes than anyone except Sammy Khan. And I know John Barry years ago told me he'd come to hate theme songs because they're usually a distraction from the picture, as he saw it. You know, if you're doing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then they have Johnny Mathis singing a ballad called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's like it's not part of the film. It's nothing other than a bit of opportunism. But the Bond songs are part of the luster.
They've become a way of life. You expect it, and you're very disappointed when the song doesn't come up to scratch. Let's face it, there's been a few disappointments with the Bond songs. David and I have discussed it many times because times have changed. Sometimes you want to go for the most popular person because you want to get a hit out of these things as well. It's not just having a good song. Therefore, you often go for popularity. And so, therefore, that flavour of Diamonds and Goldfinger, has been diluted a bit. And people, I think, feel shortchanged about it.
Yeah, I another time I ran into you, I think you'd just seen John. He'd been working with A-ha or A-ha. I forget with your Guinness Book of Hit Singles hat. Is it A-ha or
It was
A-ha.
Not an audio book. I don't know. I think it's Aha.
Who were like the Norwegian sensation of the day. James Bond, 1987. John Barry meets Aha, the living daylight.
John saying about what it was like working with them on that song, he said it was like playing table tennis with four balls.
Because the Duran song I thought was rather good.
Yes,
yeah, he very good.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. He didn't like that either, John.
James Bond theme and a number one song, John Barry and Duran Duran.
Meeting you with a view to a kill, face to face in secret places, feel the chill. You know the plans I'm making still.
How much of it did he write?
I mean, I think John, never liked to write with people. And I think they wanted to get together, as people do, as the years go by. And he was very much a lone writer. Right. And he liked to deliver his melodies and someone come up with the lyric. And he didn't like to sit down and bounce off of people. That wasn't his style. And it was too collaborative, that kind of thing.
And it must be difficult trying to write a James Bond song with John Barry and thinking that you know better or you've got a better idea. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you think the stuff that he did come up with. I know the only time that I ever tried to wrote a song with Lionel Bart, the same thing, I was sitting at the piano going, like, what on earth can I bring to this? Yeah. You know, it's almost impossible, isn't it? I mean, it's like, it's never going to be Goldfinger. You know, you kind of think, like, we might as well give up now. I mean, the idea of writing with John Barry, it's extraordinary. You think, like, well, whatever John gives us, I'll say thank you very much.
But, but it was funny because there was a period. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think if and you you only live twice, that little descending thing at the beginning of it before Nancy Sinatra comes in, that's like a beautiful thing. Yeah, but I think that sounds to me like the kind of thing a guy writes in a room by himself. You don't hit on it when you're just kind of sitting around.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. You don't go, I've got da 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 da. And then someone else goes, how about if we go?
That's right.
I don't know where to go with it after this.
Now then we get to, as we mentioned earlier, The Living Daylights, working with A-ha. And then he walked away from the series and he stayed friendly with everyone connected with it, but he had never had any urge to... He felt he'd said what he had to say about Bond, and he never felt any urge to go back.
I think that's right, David, isn't it? But that's,
and he'd done 11.
Yeah, he'd done enough. That ship has sailed, he felt. And it was also getting, that, as you mentioned before, that competition that, whoever was hot was saying maybe he should sing it, and, he wouldn't do it if he didn't write the song.
I think the auteur aspect of it had kind of disappeared slightly, and I think, John would be someone who would need to be in control of what was going on musically, and the films, by the time we got into the mid-90s, were the way that all films are, have veered so far away from that being something that anyone would do, especially with, these things are now sort of huge commercial ventures that spend an awful lot of money. So, you are kind of committed a little bit to the audience testing, studio involvement aspect to it. So, it's not just Harry and Cubby in a room. It's like it has to be more inclusive of everyone, because there's so much more involved in it, I think, now, and just the way with which you make these films change a lot. And it might be that was possibly the best thing, because I don't think you could really I don't think you can fault a single John Barry James Bond score. It was that all encompassing imprint of sort of elegant quality that John put not only on the Bond films but obviously everything.
John Barry was interesting character like that, because people who can score movies are not always songwriters. I mean, you know that, Don, from some people you've worked with. But John Barry was not just a guy who knew how to score a picture. He was actually a bona fide songwriter as well, Tim.
Well, it's just simply because he could write a good tune. Mm. I mean, you can have musical scores which work very well for the film, but there's not a single sort of strong melody, and that may not be a bad thing in some films, but I think the great film scores always have that wonderful hook in it. I remember seeing one John Barry score, and I can't remember what film it was, and I thought, what a great score, but there wasn't a sort of big tune in it, but it worked. I think it was. Did he do that Demi Moore film?
Indecent Proposal.
It was a great score, but it was.
They had a Lisa Stansfield song. She sang the melody.
In all the right places. It's another film. But sometimes you almost don't want in a score the distraction of a melody. Other times it's what makes the whole film.
No, he seemed to grow kind of anti-song towards the end. Would you say that was right? At least in terms of what they did, he felt they got in the way of a lot of.
Yeah, but also, I mean, the fact that the requirements of what a song will do in a film is so completely different, and I think the requirements of the writers are so completely different. And I think what John wasn't keen on, as time went on, was the idea that somehow he would have to kind of audition for the role of songwriter. You know, it's like we've got three or four other people, huge artists, you know, who are interested in doing this. So would you put in yours with theirs and be considered? You know, and I don't think he was interested in that kind of approach to filmmaking either. You know, I think he was very much, his ideal was give me the film and I'll come back and give you the score, which. All of his finest work was when that happened, you know.
And
he got 5 Oscars for doing exactly that, although, curiously, none of them for a Bond.
did Bond songs, I should know this, did they win any Oscars?
No.
As a Bond song?
No. John was never nominated. John Barry was never nominated for a Bond score or a song.
That's it. Unbelievable.
Which is unbelievable.
That is incredible, because, and you have to feel there's some, there was some perverse kind of snobbery or something about it, isn't it?
But it's never won.
But we should, at this point, we should mention that you and John won an Oscar, Don, for your song Born Free. You were the first British songwriters ever to win an Oscar, and I think John also won for the score for that picture as well. What's harder, writing a song about a plot called Thunderball or a song about a lion?
Well, it doesn't matter, really. I mean, so much luck goes into all these things, Mark. I mean, you know, when people look back on these hits, everyone wants an anecdote. And, you know, an anecdote is not always forthcoming, because really what happened with Born Free, for example, you know, Carl Foreman didn't like the lyric and he didn't like the music. And it's as simple as that. And it was too late. It was too late to get it out of the picture. He wanted the song to be about jungles and lions and cages.
Right.
And he didn't like the melody. And he said to me, Don, he said, you've written a social comment. You know, the film isn't a social comment. But it went on. And, you know, I've said this before, but it always gets a laugh, and I hope it will now. when I won the Oscar, when Dean Martin gave it to me that night, and as I was coming off stage, Carl Foreman was there. He put his arm round me and said, well, it does grow on you.
As the wind blows, as free as the grass grows, born free to follow your heart. Live free, and beauty surrounds you. The world still astounds you. It's time you look at a star.
Matt Monro on the film soundtrack. It certainly did grow on people after it won the Oscar. Everybody sang it. It's the only John Barry tune to be recorded by both Trini Lopez.
Live free and beauty surrounds you. The world still astounds you. Each time you look at a star.
And the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Oh, and Frank Sinatra.
Born free, and life is worth living. But only worth living, 'cause you're born free.
Yeah. John Barry didn't write a lot of songs in the last few years, but tell us about how you reunited Don and John with Shirley Bassey a couple of years back for her first new album in forever, David.
You know, when we made the Shirley Bassey record, and I asked John to write a song for her, because he hadn't written her a song for years and years and years, 25 years, I think it was. And, you know, I asked if Don would write a song with John for Shirley Bassey, because that would be a big deal. You know, it's a big deal for me, and it'd be a big deal for people who loved any of these people who are involved. And he faxed me over the melody and the chords, and that was a single melody and just the chords. And you just play it on the piano, and you start laughing, because it's like, it's four notes, and it's like, we must have heard those before. Yeah. I must have. It goes da dee da da. Immediately, you know, it's John Barry. It's sort of annoying, but it's aspirational. You know, it's like, you think, like, it's a lifetime. You know, it's the old Picasso signing the handkerchief story.
Yeah.
You know.
Not one day soon, your eyes don't lie. Look how bright the stars and how close the moon. Our time is now and evermore. It took a while.
Last songs Don Black and John Barry wrote together. Not long after that final James Bond score for The Living Daylights, John's health took a turn for the worse. By the time I met him, he was something of a gaunt and rather frail figure, a long way from the cool cat with the grooviest dolly birds in the swinging 60s. And perhaps because of intimations of mortality, there was a change in the music too. Less screaming brass and filthy guitars, and more melancholic strings and elegiac woodwinds, almost pastoral, as David said earlier. Very different from Goldfinger or Diamonds Are Forever, but still unmistakably John Barry. And I wondered if you'd like to pick a favourite or two from that later period, Don.
Well, I ended up doing lyrics to Out of Africa and Dances with Wolves, although they weren't in the film. And that's—I mean—that was him at his peak. Those melodies, Out of Africa, and I mean, just remarkable, expansive score and goosebumps all the way.
Thank you.
those beautiful tunes, they feel like they're written for me. You know, they feel like they're written for you personally. They don't feel like they've been written for some huge project. You know, you feel somehow there is a very personal connection to it. You know, that beautiful phrase, if it, you know, if it's written from the heart, it goes to the heart. It just feels like, you know, John had a huge heart for that kind of music, and the way that it reaches you in such a sort of personal and direct way, very, very rare, I think, a very, very rare talent.
Had his signature on everything. That's one thing you can say about John. You know it's John Barry from the opening chords. I don't know why it is, because as you've said, you know, they're quite simple, you say, these chords, and yet then,
yeah,
I don't know how we know the, I'm not musical enough to know
why
they're John Barry.
Well, I think the jazz inflections make them far more complex than as it otherwise seems when you hear it,
yeah.
In order to get the voicings to make those sounds, but I mean, for me, it was Mary, Queen of Scots and yes, Somewhere in Time. You know, that were both
Somewhere in Time's
kind of staggeringly beautiful tunes. As you so rightly put it, it feels like there's a man in a room by himself searching for those melodies, you know, and whatever you have to get through to get that out of yourself, you know, the effort that it takes and the soul searching that it takes and the sacrifices that one have to make and the life you have had to have lead to get to that point when you can write those kinds of tunes, because they're not Beat Girl, certainly. You know, I think that's where the satisfaction is when you listen to it, is that you are taken by the hand and led very securely to all these places that you might, I think, otherwise might only really dream about. And I think that sort of sense of yearning and longing that's in his music is the thing that makes everyone want to put a John Barry tune at their wedding or at a funeral or anywhere where there's emotion.
Somewhere in Time, music by John Barry, composer, arranger, trumpeter. We barely skimmed the surface of his work today. We never got to Midnight Cowboy, Zulu, Dances with Wolves, Billy, Lolita, but we will. A great composer, as Ian Fleming and Leslie Bricus might say, only lives twice, one life for himself and one for his music. And an awful lot of John Barry's compositions, like Diamonds, are forever. We focused on the 007 side of things. We brought an awful lot of pleasure to millions of filmgoers around the world. David, you've got a great line on the impact of that music.
Well, I mean, in terms of like how it makes you feel, but you can be driving a Ford Fiesta on, you know, in a traffic jam, the M25. You put a bit of John Barry on, and you know you're in an Aston Martin and in the south of France.
Thank you.
I can think of plenty of times I've been in the National Martin south of France, mm-hmm. put on a record and imagine suddenly I'm on the M25 in a Ford really? Fiesta. Usually a rat record.
Yeah, well, actually, if they have that impact, it's only a matter of time before EU health and safety ban listening yes. to John Barry scores in your vehicle. Jim Rice, Don Black, David Arnold, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
On the Town is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises. All rights reserved.